Okay, so what I want to do, and this really is intended much more of the conversation of a lecture, but I have some points to make about the Masoretz, but those are tangential. The major issue is, if we have that here, is self-described as an attempt to see whether the framework of Lashon Hara can function in a democratic community. Right, that's the question. And so the fundamental question, and it works on the premise that it must be possible, or at least that it should be possible, for Orthodox Jews to participate in the political process. Whereas, we can set up a prima facie case that Orthodox Jews can't participate in the political process because the political process also involves saying bad things about other people. Right, you can't just, you tend to say bad things about the other parties in the race. As a reporter, you tend to say bad things about both people in the race. If our goal is to not say bad things about people, then political process is a bad idea. On the other hand, in a democratic political process, it seems that probably being down the cusp good and never saying anything negative about somebody does not redound to the public benefit in the sense that people make wise choices. Right? So you try to see if you can reconcile this. But doesn't succeed. Yes, sir.
I was just going to say that I think it's important to make the distinction between something written for an Israeli context versus for a
Palestinian
context. Because he's in a situation where there's more of a need to assume that it is possible for a Jew to participate in a democratic process. In a way, than the hopes are, there's, I think, potentially a stronger Havamina, though I disagree, that maybe Orthodox Jews should just not be involved.
Yeah, it's not right. It's true. He's functioning within a very strong religious Zionist perspective, right? And it's entirely possible for somebody to argue that in America we should just resort to the standard, the traditional modes of bribery, and leave aside participation in democratic classes. That's true. I don't know what he would say. I will say, and I start from the premise that this is a fundamental premise where I come from many issues, that being a citizen of democracy imposes moral responsibility for the decisions of that democracy, and therefore it is a failure to fulfill a religious obligation, and certainly in some cases, such as Lotal and Zamriach and other things, a violation of the term Dioraita for Orthodox Jews not to participate intelligently in the and seriously in the halachic process, in the democratic process. So I'm not going to make that distinction, but it is certainly within your grounds to say that you would, and it's certainly entirely possible that Rabbi Ariel would have. Okay, so we come out of here convinced that we have here a framework that enables some people to participate in the democratic process as is, that if you had that you can be a political candidate and follow these rules plausibly, you can be a reporter and follow these rules plausibly. Or is this just all fantasy? The authors that tell us, I don't know, how we would, other things we have run, how we would run the power company? If you ran the power company? Yes,
I think in a lot of ways, the model he sets up, first part, he didn't finish the part, so I don't want to, but he's actually even more practically, so I don't want to, maybe he actually does manage to work it out. The model he sent out in the first half, I think in a lot of ways is unrealistic.
Okay, what are the ways?
I mean, he has this, basically what he wants to do is open it up such that you are allowed to make ad hominem, it's very strange, right? So he says, first of all, obviously, you can write more or less anything you want about people who violate the law, especially if they do so in the public eye.
Right.
And that's the first thing, right? So, okay, so fine. But we've basically got rid of all Easter Egg, Lashon Hara, and Muslims. Right? That's gone. So, I mean, morally, maybe I find that somewhat problematic, although, and especially, you know, it becomes, depending upon what kind of society you want to build, right, in the actual physical state of Israel, right, and probably in most places that aren't, and also in places that aren't Israel, right, what ends up resulting then is you can have all kinds, within the Army of Bolsonaro, you can have any kinds of ad hominem attacks you want. But of course, right, they can't attack you because you are, you know, you're philosophy upright.
Yeah.
That's the first thing, which I think is, you know, like, the game is rigged from the start. Mm-hmm. In a lot of ways, set up a system that's totally in favor of people who share his views on how the individual should be run.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first part, which isn't a sort of halakhic objection, but I think of a larger systemic problem. But the second piece is that also, he has this weird thing where he then wants to mutter more or less any kind of ad hominem attacks against people who are, with whom you just have simple policy agreements. I think that's what he's saying at the end, right? So not any kind, they all have to be true, right?
Yeah.
But you can basically, like, in the conclusion, he says, you know, what he calls subjective disagreements.
Yeah.
There seem to be cases in which it is not clear whether or not there's a tolelet. There are people who honestly disagree about whether or not there's a tolelet, right? Well, that could be considered a case of tolelet, and therefore you can deal with it harder than two.
Tell me what you're talking about there, Scott.
This is not Scott. Yeah, at the end of, I mean, he has a longer discussion earlier, right?
Yeah.
He has a funny footnote where he basically says, so, you know, it's clear that you can discuss, it's clear that anyone who's actually over, you know, Isor Halakha, you can say much and hard about that, those of errors. But maybe if they're only over Das Torah, it's not okay. You can't say it. That's what he has done, that's like individual discussion. But then I don't know what's going. He just right.
Give me a page
number. Page 51, the bottom. What's going in the first section.
Okay.
Doing what I understood to be like a very, very broad head there. Right, he says, where is this? Right. You told about the Rimo, well, that should be court, or you sorry if you go to the beginning, or some problem with the wallet, and therefore, right, I'm going to be court never, and you could not know about the activity. Right?
Okay.
Even from these sort of, he defines subjective as cases in which people often disagree about the issue.
Okay.
Right? The Zoki Shum Shigam Matsuk is that comment, I'm supposed to be simple with the wallet. Because he's a Kabe in order to have his, he's a Kabein that because he did what he thinks is the best for the country, it's okay for him to speak Lashon Hara. Right? Lamasa and the Korn Hara...
Doesn't mean that you can criticize, you talk about criticism.
Yeah.
Not the same thing as you can talk about their private sex life.
No, absolutely. But, okay. but criticism, which is Lashon Hara, right? But presumably, if you're feeling embarrassed in their private sex life, you can talk about that. About that. You can say that, that's fine. Right, those kinds of cases are not an issue for him whatsoever.
Right.
On publicizing those things are fine.
Right.
It's basically great because you can have all kinds of spirit campaigns against people.
Yeah.
The Mata, the court of the Maraca Democracy, gave a college campus to being Maraca Bicharut Bicharut, and he gets into public discussion and campaign ads.
Right.
Right. Well, it seems to me that within the realm, see, my issue is not that it's impossible, my issue is that it's just a Lashon Hara anymore.
Uh-huh.
That's my issue.
So, you don't think he's getting into Lashon Hara?
What?
You think he doesn't leave any history of Lashon Hara?
I think he doesn't leave any history of Lashon Hara whatsoever. Within the realm of campaign ads against people with whom you disagree.
Uh-huh. Well, you can't.
That's my issue, right? He says very clearly, right? It's, like, if there's what he calls a subjective case, which is a case in which you think there is a tolelet, but other people think it's not a tolelet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And which cannot be proven in any kind of way except for from your own personal political views, you can say more or less, you can, that should be fully public no matter what it is. I think he, in those cases, he's totally getting rid of both the Israel Bush and her.
Okay. Good.
And I got the problem. I think there needs to be, because the passage of the Russian Hara decision, all right, this is a serious issue, and it's a serious issue, and
okay. Any other legitimate perspectives?
Well,
yeah.
I mean, I'm just afraid of that because it legitimates anything that's within the realm of self-respect.
Yeah.
In a certain respect. Well, I kind of want to touch your show begins on in the city and sort of, why bring it to the forefront then that it's going to be, let me try again. I think what's missing for me is if it's going to be something that's written as a sense of public review.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'd like to see some sort of clause come with it, which I didn't find, that says, and this is how they have to improve. Being that to not just report, but also to demand the standard. Like, right now, it just seems important too much.
Uh-huh. Did you guys read Title 63 on page 61? It's a very cool footnote. Let's look at the paragraph, the page 61. Let's look at the second to last paragraph, and see if we can really get what the thesis is. He says the chance between Hamulim and the two in the two categories above, namely campaigns and actual governance, right? The perspective, because that about of the community is subjective. If you criticize somebody, it's not because when you criticize somebody's political positions, it's not because you know that their political positions are wrong. It's because you believe that their political criticisms are wrong. And so when you say so and so will lead to the destruction of the country, it's not because you know that. It's because that is your best political judgment. So he says the obligation of the elected to the voters, I'm translating as I go along, you can see, right, does not arise because the voters are demonstrably correct, but rather because the elected officials are the agents of the voters. Okay, now that, of course, is a matter of huge controversy, right, as to what exactly the relationship of elected officials is to voters. Are they delegates or representatives? Right? I just want to figure out exactly what the term of the criteria is. Is it delegate or
representative?
If you're a delegate, it means you're just supposed to fulfill their will, and if you represent, it means that you're supposed to stand, right, that they are delegating their judgment to you, as opposed to that you're making you the agent of their judgment. Okay, I'm not sure that there's nafkamina in the nafkamina here. It just makes me nervous when people come down on one side of a very complicated political figure and then act halachically on the presumption they understand the issue. And therefore, even if in other circumstances we would not accept the conclusion or the determination that a subjective conviction permits the saying of Lashon Hara L'Tu'alet, right? So ordinarily, they would claim that you have to have some kind of objective confirmation of your Tu'alet. We can accept it with regard to democratic structures, where the whole purpose, the whole task, or the proper task of the elected officials is dependent on the community being involved in their work. Now, how do you understand that argument? Right, in halachic terms, right, trying to reformulate an argument, right, what's the heter? Right, ordinarily, if you want to make the claim that ordinarily, Lashon Hara is dependent on objective criteria, and therefore, for example, he says that in a totalitarian country, criticism of officials is completely prohibited. Am I being unfair? What exactly is it that is not your subjective criticism of officials? Then figure out whether that would apply to appointed officials, whether it would apply to dictators. That's the question I'm asking. What exactly is that? Well, more likely to go in a door.
I'm not sure history.
Get an opportunity. let's leave that question out, right? Let's assume that you're dealing with a from dictatorship. They're non-Jews, they keep the show in this book. Well, the haphazard is that, the same thing that happens to the Democratic officials is that if you make enough of a stink about the appointed officials, then eventually their bosses will pull away from them, and they'll get replaced. Right, but the manner in which you exert influence in an authoritarian country is not through elections. Right, it's not a formal. It's not because Kohani Shlukei Dandaim. It's Kohani Shlukei Rachmanim, and we pray and try to influence God. So even if you hold the Shlukim are the agent of that's the officials of the agent of the emperor, not the agent of the population. Nonetheless, right, you create influence. But in his mechanism, is that Mutter? Right, Ali, what do you want to say?
I think that's something inherent in
democracy itself, and any person working on natural democracy
provide that.
Okay. And so now, how does the heads of the democracy work? Can you explain it? Public accountability. Why is public accountability a good?
I'm not sure. Without giving the sense of Lashon Hara, how God democracy would set up. So given democracy, if you also have Lashon Hara, if you don't give Lashon Hara for it, democracy would set up.
Why will it fail?
What?
Why will it fail? Is that the way he frames it? Accountability to the public? What's the language he uses? And it says, Sh'etzem tafkidan shvi tafkidan, probably right, the typo. Itkin atakin t'loy demuravot shalom tibur v'filatan. So I don't understand that. Yeah, what do you want to say?
Well, at the very beginning, he says that he doesn't believe that a democratic society can function without, like, a free press and the public knowing what's going on. So, I don't know if it's really anti-perception, but he definitely really said that as, like, as, I guess, at the end of point, like, he doesn't think that you can have a democracy.
Okay, I think that's true. I'm just, I'm interested in defining it or convenience point more precisely. But then the question is, has he come with formal language that successfully embodies? So that it successfully embodies the Archimedean point in Halakha? Or is it that he hasn't quite succeeded in doing it? Yes, Jesse?
I think it's kind of a mechanical argument, right?
Yeah.
The nature of democracy is such, right, that elected officials function as representatives of the voters, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in order for that, that mechanism to function, there has to be open communication, right, between the agents and their masters, who are the voters. Not just both during elections, when the agents are being selected, and in between elections, to make sure that the agents are doing what they're
masters want them to do. So I think, and at the cost of some races, these simple maintenance of this mechanism, right, is itself a quality. And therefore, and given that they have multiple masters and there's the process by which, you know, the process by which the will of the public gets conveyed to the representative is this sort of adversarial political process, oftentimes, at which with various different people are stating their views as to how the country should be run, right, that the process itself, right, and he earlier when he speaks about the process, right, he compares it to two sets of idiom representing two separate parties going for precedent, right? So this is like really the way you work it out in the Gemara to make it happen, right? He says, look, when two idiom go to precedent, you know, make three testimony for opposite sides, right? Their job is to present their view of what went on, mm-hmm. right? In order that the big team can fulfill their function, judge what really happened and reach a verdict. So he sees the political process, he says, so too in the political process, right, there's a similar thing happens, whereby voters and constituents, right, present their view of how things happened to their representative, and the representative's job to figure out from that what the more general will of the people is and follow that. And that's how I think they had to function for him in a democracy.
Good. So right now, it seems clear that in fact it is dependent on the vision of elected officials as functioning solely as delegates. Right? For the job of an elected official is to figure out the will of the collective, which is of course an abstraction, which has its event. And the only way to do that is not only by knowing what people's opinions are, in which they raise so they can send you things, but you also have to let the opinions clash with each other. So the whole purpose of this conversation is solely, and the only benefit for the conversation is because otherwise the elected official would not be properly able to determine the will of the people and carry it out. The question of whether the elected official benefits in terms of his judgments from hearing other people's positions is not devised or not arise. The question is whether this, and this presents, right, rejects the position, it makes it fundamentally, I guess, utter for a Knesset member to vote against the will of the electors. Now, how do you make this claim in the Knesset, DASCA, when you don't represent any specific people? And right, and there are people elected, right, and so you are elected to represent specific positions. Right. It was just the upfront, the Phyllis photo, this is not good political science. This is really not good political science. And to build the Hetzer for Lashon Hara, right, for, to build the Hetzer for expressing subjective positions about public policy on democracy, as opposed to on issue of governance, is, dangerous. You know, in the end, you know, it's a lie. And since it turns out that this is now considered to be the best way to run, right, the best way to run a government. So in Ayla, we can say that whatever happens in appropriate democratic forums is considered a toilet, because right now we think that it's a fascinating, convincing argument, right? The public toilet is to have good governance. Currently make the determination that adversarial elections are the best way to run good governance, although we take no position of our own about that. Therefore, anything which generates public governance is considered democratic controversy is considered to us. Then you have to put on 53, which says that of course not actual politics. Right, we're not talking about what is determined in practice to good governance, we're talking about what is considered ideal governance. Right, so we do as we say, right, so we're sort of like saying the Constitution, as we all know, was designed to prevent factions from forming. We all know that was the purpose of the Constitution, and you can't get anything more antithetical to the intent of the framers than political parties. Now it happens that American political governance has developed political parties, but regrettably this does not match what he calls So participation in political parties in America is absurd. Because it just happens to be that we all understand political parties to be edited. Right? No, we probably need a way to say.
Okay. I realize that he probably doesn't make this argument, but I think that you could very easily apply this sort of reasoning in a context of elected officials representing the president. I think what you can say is that that an election is about determining which is, rather than which is the candidate whose ideology most matches that of the electorate, but whether, which candidate has virtue, the greatest virtue. And then you also end up with having more disparity for, it becomes more of a choice to talk about people's personal lives, because then...
Yeah, and I agree that you could do it, he doesn't.
Right.
Right, he doesn't. You could reconstruct the theory. And with Aura, all criticism of appointed officials is up there.
No, it's not, no, because the only way to influence the people who are higher up when it comes to appointed officials is by going to...
Well, people higher up have decided they don't want to be influenced. They issued a rule, which they said criticism is right. They let's say...
Look at what happened in Mario.
They issued the Alien Sedition Act. Right? So you can't claim that the agreed political structure that good governance requires a free press. The agreed political structure that good governance requires the suppression of a free press. You just happen to disagree and you think there should be a free press. Sorry, you're up there because there's not a lot of criticism when it conflicts with the agreed upon political order. No? Yes,
I understand. I think, yeah, I'm not sure you're playing, but perhaps the thing you indicated that government is a social contract, but if your government you have the way that's best to get the people through out of the agreement, right?
Yeah.
It's confusing, right? You know how to govern, well, you run to whether you're governing or senator. And then you see the fact of an issue, right? You see, kind of walking into the contract, right? You have agreement of people allowing the rule, and therefore, if something comes out that would affect that agreement about your being into the rule, right, that's something that people, have to hear, they can get addressed whether they, agree that you can work. Right, so now, that would apply to both Democrats and any form of government, right? Because, you don't have the option of revolt, whether successful or not, is an issue.
Right.
But so now if something comes out that you found out that your local dictator, you start with the Netherlands, but often you find out that you're interested in puppies, and that camel shot back, is laughter, right? You didn't know why you're here. So that becomes as well, because it actually affects more impression of the person. Or can't it goes into that.
Let's say a non-democratic organization, right? The yeshiva. Any yeshiva, the person appointed as mashkiach makes the determination that henceforth the policy will be that there will be no air conditioning in the midrash in the summer because he determined, determined that it's not. Really, nobody, really, any issue has been with his fault. Come on, cool with what? And you want to say, wow, that's a bad idea? Can you tell your friend, well, I think Moshkiach just had a bad idea, because in fact, I learn a lot better when it's cool. Why do you have the right to influence the donors? Unless the donors set up
the donors. Do the donors have the influence over the yeshiva? They can decide whether or not they're going to continue giving rights to the yeshiva. And
So?
Once he's already the Messiah.
No, but he's making a bad policy move. And it's a series of bad policy moves that's going to really affect life in Yeshiva.
What?
Mm.
Why can't you tell the owner?
You can claim that the political...
Are you sure it's the board is the board of Harvard, right?
But that's
really
fine. I understand what you're saying.
Board.
It seems that they're denying that.
The board is accusing itself, like the scientists. Like it's self-perpetuating oligarchy.
I recognize that. Am I correctly describing this with your claim by saying that it's not the higher ups who get to determine that the political structure works, but rather the people on the ground also decide what the correct political structure is. So the dictator can't decide which is the correct, what's his right to say, this is the correct way to do it. Know what you're saying?
Not entirely. What I'm saying is, I think that there are people who have a right. Well, in the end, it's the relationship's decision what to do. At the same time, whatever the Rosh Hashiva is going to decide, that is going to have consequences. And if, the Rosh Hashiva makes a decision that will cause people to leave, and the students and the donors have a right to...
Right, so you're saying is everyone affected, right, has the right to information.
Yeah.
Right, but he doesn't make that claim. That's not right. He doesn't say that everyone affected. He claims that the system, that the legitimate system, right, acknowledges that as a good, not that we have an abstract conviction, right, that all parties affected have a right to knowledge. I know those two very different claims. Don't get everybody away for a while.
It's in your case, but the Russian is the Messiah.
Yeah.
So, it's not that the right that people to talk about stuff in democracy comes from the fact that they're in the court, or the right to find out.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that your parallel is wrong, because the employer of Mashiach is the board, the donors, the Shiva, the company, but not the students. Okay? But in this case, the correct place to go with that information is to somebody who has the power to stop it, somebody who is going to be damaged by the disruption of the Yeshiva. And whoever the responsible party is, that's who they should be going to, and if they say no, who's going to stop it? The private institution.
That's a very sensitive point for me. But let's look at it. Because the hypothetical board of a public non-profit, and this is, of course, a very sensitive issue at Harvard, as was an issue at Yeshiva, with regard to the graduate school. I think the board holds it in public trust. I don't think the board owns it.
The institution is big enough, then you can claim that one system is.
Yeah.
I don't like how you're operating things in the CMT. You haven't said that you could publish an article on the box of gold without your being sure. I think I call six people who unfortunately don't quite know they're on your board and tell them to fire I think it's only the scale of the institution that turns why you can see the center of the modern class quote that makes it...
Not the catalyst.
What?
Not the catalyst. Where the catalyst?
What do you mean?
Why do you believe the center? Where the catalyst?
I know, when we're a place where our air conditioning goes off, then it affects tens of thousands of people, then we could talk about random strangers that having to be their business. We're not that scale of inclusion right now, and I don't think it's
This is like, just follow up on that, or what the person was supposed to. I mean, I just don't know that I don't think he tells us anything about these other cases, right? There may very well be all kinds of hetering to deal with the Mashiach. I think the one that Deborah said made a lot of sense to me, within some of the things that he said, right? But he's not talking about those cases. He's talking about specifically how to make the political process work within a democracy according to the law of Washington Para. And, within that limited case, that's all we really know about his opinion, aside from global aside here and there about smaller cases, right? And he may, in fact, also have a framework within which
free press and, you know, openness works within some kind of a dictatorship. You may have one for smaller institutions which are run by boards. He may not. I don't know. Maybe the fact that he doesn't make a broader argument implies that he doesn't. Because if he had a broader, if he had a broader argument, he might have applied it here. But maybe there are small limited arguments within each one of these different kinds of systems that work, and he has a whole bunch of them. I don't know. I just don't know that we can say that this particular head there does not work within Yeshiva, it does not work within a fascist system, and it does not work within a monarchy, it does not work within a communitarian government, whatever. It only works within the specific situations of modern liberal democracy. I don't know that we can say what he thinks about these other cases. I think what we can say is that he has not given us a way to deal with those situations.
Okay. And it would be helpful coincidence if he came to the same conclusions in each system. That happened through a different framework for each of them.
Yeah, for sure. But I mean, this is the argument he chooses to make for rather obvious reasons, right? Because that's the system he's living in. And I just don't know that we can make broader claims for him.
Okay. Jasmine, what is the look at the premium?
It's not entirely clear to me.
Good. Give me some options.
He has a decision on page 52,
mm-hmm.
where he makes an argument, which is, you know, written in the middle of the page. Right? He suggests that the first full paragraph, I didn't put a shot on my shot right off on the tour in the lane.
Page 52?
Page 52. Over here, it's clear that his agenda here is simply to explain, based on our system, as messed up as it may be, right, how we have to justify the Lashon Hara to the Toelet in these circumstances, to the point where he's willing to say that because the other side, the less hagun side, who's not following halacha, will end up attacking you, and if you don't attack back, to some extent, then the less hagun side will come out, and we have to justify the election, because that's what the people who discuss the proper way that democracy should run, saying that democracy should be run, therefore, and comes up with an argument of why it's therefore Lashon Hara l'Toelet. But, you know, it's clear from other places that he's, you know, he's really very much committed to justifying, you know, democracy as he sees it, as it is right now in Israel. And he doesn't necessarily make any claims about anything else, and I'm not sure he can extend anything he says.
Well, so long for this to agree.
What? And then he says, I'll turn to the low and government of Shilo, 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 Shilo,
What's the connection?
Right. So the overall article seems to be going, how do I justify it practically? And then suddenly, right, the footnote 52 goes against it because he says, right, I'm not actually trying to justify, you know, the practical one, like he did, you know, very strongly in page 52 to the, you know, in a very, very, I think, circular way, you know, monitoring, damaging someone else so that because they're going to damage you anyways, they will become stronger than you, and that can't be, because that wouldn't work out in the, you know, position we've already set up. So there, it's clear, he's justifying it practically. And that's how he's justifying Lashon Hara with Tevelet, and that's how he's saying Matzer. Then, the problem, I don't really know what Fizzy means, because then here, he's suddenly taking a step back from what he argued in the article itself, which was, you know, that we know we have to take that guilt conception of democracy and figure out what would be best under those circumstances, and, you know, what we consider to allow for that, without actually looking at our corrupt political system. Therefore, I'm not really sure what he means here. He means to take a step back from what he, or just, he's just contradicting himself. It's just unclear to me.
Michael, what do you
want to
say? Maybe
nothing.
Alright, this is a big problem to me.
I think he's being, it looks as a contradiction or he's a critical, but I mean, I don't know, on the other hand, you could say that he's being very honest and that he has serious moral or maybe even halakhic concerns about the system which already exists. But the fact remains that this is a system that he has to sort of work within, and he doesn't want to just... I mean, it's a lose-lose situation. If he upholds the standards of the democratic society which already exists before him, then he's not able to maintain his true understanding of halakha or virtue or ethics or whatever. And if he does uphold the virtue and ethics of halakha, then he'll just be crushed. And he won't have a place in the system, and nothing will ever come of what he wants to advance in the political society. So in either case, he's really at a loss. So I guess he sort of just decides, well, maybe I'm going to just have to be pragmatic about this and say to myself that although I know deep in my gut that this is not halakhically or ethically okay, I need to somehow function within the society, and this is the best compromise that I can come up with.
Let's play it out. In a society, most people are bombed. Everyone has political influence. If I try to have political influence and the other side is bombed, then I will lose. So I have to just find the right path when they're finding me. Now, I think, like, my underlying thing here is, is he worried about himself as a person? What is he worried about?
I think he's worried about the religious place in his own society.
He's worried about, right, what he's writing is a justification of the existence of the national religious law.
Yeah,
sure. And we should be put out, right? This is not about a theory of politics. It's not about how can a lot of function in democracy. This is about, wow, we have religious parties. Religious parties do ugly, ugly things all the time. And it seems to me like being a religious party requires you to be non-religious. No! Guess what? We can find a way to be a religious party and behave just as well as everybody else. Right? And that doesn't change the fact because that doesn't change anything.
And how do you
have a
mirror? I mean, like, and then I'm trying to decide, do I see myself as ugly and corrupt? Or do I see myself as somehow justified because, you know, this is, I just have to play fire with fire.
So what I want to me, like, the vision of democracy here does not involve any kind of shared task. And he's not talking about what you have to do to be a good citizen. Right? He's just talking about how you advance the interests of a particular faction in that society, in which, right, there are religious parties and everybody else. So the question is, of course, the religious party only united against everyone else, and that is one set of rules. But he has no interest in talking about what the rules of politics should be. What he's interested in is, what are the rules of politics that religious parties have to play by?
Yeah.
All right, so this is not a, Chris, I would, you know, this, I'd say, it'll be, you know, fundamental critique. Right, this is kind of, he has no interest in taking responsibility for Israeli politics. He has no interest in also taking responsibility. Israeli politics is a sick system, right, that was come up with by social democracy cartoons. That's what it is. Right, so we can make our peace with it. And our job is not to figure it out. Our job is not to champion any kind of vision of what the system ought to be. Because you know what the system ought to be, right? The system ought to be that revelation rule. Right? So we're stuck. Right? They only said their authority. So we have to come to terms with it, and instead of terms we recognize that, right, that engaging in this kind of political process is yucky. But it becomes mutter, because the time we get to the yucky things will tell us. But we don't want to really say that we're just like them, because if we're just like them, then what's the point of our winning? Just so we can keep Shabbos? Right, we have to have a step back at the last moment and say, well, we of course fight by the norms of the higher ideal. We should then specify the next article. I think that footnote 53 is instructions to the second section. How does it? Okay, so I'm being harsh. John, are you harsh on me?
No, there was one point where it was just an attack on it, it was one footnote,
footnote
30. Yeah. In one of his discussions, he establishes, obviously, he talks against people who go against Allah. And then he comes again. That's the one point where he knows that he's very weak. And which is when it was, the Mahogany that his yeshiva was about to say, Muslim and etc., about whether or not I can talk against the people who hold the spirit with us, where suddenly it's no longer against me. Not for Mahdi Carson. He knows that the reason is in his argument, the second he starts attacking people, he himself is big. Or would have trouble denying are on his team, usually.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to come up with this very strange move of a stock which was based by his rebellion on the Haskama of most of the post-him, with the exception of the Svarni Gadol Hador, is clearly the only halakha to follow, and therefore any opposition is fira, and therefore can be challenged in what an art can be said about it. Which, to me was just when speaking of one of the strongest indications that, it's purely a justification of his particular move, because the weakest, here he's not fighting the rest of the Israeli system, he's fighting the rest of the religious Zionist movement.
Who doesn't
really care. So,
that was just my,
Okay, yes,
well. I would say that one of the things that I think we have to give a little bit of credit for is that he basically sees the way the current political system works as being completely idiotic.
Yeah.
He has a conception of Muslim Lashkara that allows itself to adapt to incredibly different situation. Now, the way in which he does it, we can find issue with. But I think what he does make an important point is we have to realize that we're not dealing with rabbis, we're dealing with politicians. And any sort of system that we set up might not necessarily we can't necessarily expect the best out of it.
And all the politicians of the left party have to
say
stuff.
Well,
except
the women.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the Sterling part of the article.
Yeah.
But he is willing to say, well, if we have that, we can be nasty. And we'll find some demise in there, and some time in there. There will be a young man, so like, if you can find those lucky for you, like, let me do what all the other discussing corrupt politicians are inside of.
Well, we went through Ben Yoda. I wanted to point out to you that Ben Yoda was a great NATO. Right. I tried very hard to make that point. That the science is based on Ben Yoda. And Ben Yoda is a tremendous NATO in practice. But if you are interested in framing things, if you're framing things, here's what I'm going to frame the argument. What I tried to argue all the way through is that there is a virtue conception of Lashon Hara, and there is a policy conception of Lashon Hara. What Rav Yona does to defend the virtue conception of Lashon Hara, is to leave almost nothing out there from the policy perspective. So as long as you're dealing in a communal context where there are no policy reasons to speak Lashon Hara. We're just talking about a community where basically everyone agrees with everyone else. Then it looks really not fair. So you can't say anything to anybody. Right? Because there's no formal exception at all, it's only policy. And so there's no policy reasons to do it. Right? So the time looks really not fair. As soon as you get out of the closed community, right, to the other closed community, and you start raising the question of whether I should be thinking about this not in terms of what I do for myself, since my own spiritual development, but what accomplishes, there are no limits. Right, you go back to your Lohana and they say, anything's much of a Lohana, and that's it. Right, so I really wanted to make that distinction and recognize that's what there is. Now, you can show what happens textually, right, that the Yona in order to protect the virtual interest in the text of Ape Plata opens up all the policies, right, all the policies to him. And I want to show how that happens with Mazda, right, that because the Chavetz Chaim has no formal distinctions in Lashon Hara, therefore he has no defense in a policy context. In principle. Now he tries to, and this is what the second section of the article is, to come up with the seven categories in which you can say things as well. But in principle, and I think it's like a deep lesson to show how, a virtue conception which is shared with the notion that you have a closed society just breaks down into the outside world. And that's where what happens in terms of relationships on Jews left and right. Whereas if you have a conception which is built entirely on how you perfect yourself, and you just think that that only functions, that only applies in the universe, as soon as you start talking about how does my community relate to other communities, well, then all this goes out the window and get locked in the mother. I think this is a generic flaw, not a specific flaw. But because he recognizes that this is a flaw, because I think correctly he looks in the mirror and says, yuck. So then you end up trying to see if you can find some way, having been master everything on a policy level, whether there's still some way you can put virtue back in. And so the rest of it, the second half of the article is, okay, let's take the kind of same set in models of what's all it, and see if we can plug them in to create some kind of way in which, while we engage in this political mess, there's still some kind of control of what we do. So for example, we have criteria 6. Can you cause this to all it by some means other than this? Well, we have criteria 3. So you have to be mochiach the chose privately first. Now, do you think those work in a political context? It's not fair for me to criticize your policy position unless I can get an appointment in your office first and explain to you why I think that nuclear power is really a bad idea. And so, it might be in person be better than a letter. Right, I don't know, right? You know, people are much more influenced by in-person conversations, and I have to try every possible means before I publish. So I can send a letter first, and then I have to go try to make an appointment. And after I make an appointment, then I can possibly publish an op-ed in which I say this is a dumb idea. And of course, I have to consider the possibility that there are means other than public criticism that would get you to change your mind, whatever they may be. And besides, I could try to get you elected on other grounds.
That's what Gary was talking about. He said that it's all being used, and you don't need to have a bad decision on the article. We asked him after that question, and he said yes, and no, it was a problem. He said, I think he said, yeah, right, but, there was a
Yeah, this is a really powerful framework in the Code of Triumph, and I love it in real personal life, and it works really well in a closed community where everybody knows everybody else and is accountable to everyone else directly. But it's not a plausible way of thinking about whether I should criticize Barack Obama's healthcare policy. Right, just I have a clear to go make an appointment with the president to tell him socialized medicine bad. that's not what's going on.
So the structure of the community is different.
Yes.
You don't have the church. You don't have the Jewish council.
That's right.
So I think you may know becomes very practical when you just say. Times have changed, you use that a lot of people, and that it needs to be different. The system works through a lot, works through journalism.
But journalists and letter writers and political, everyone should have to, if they have anything negative to say about anybody's policy prescriptions, they should have to go tell that person privately first.
Back to your staff. I know it exists in a community which is smaller,
and once
the community
isn't
like that, then you have to apply that rule to
the
framework.
So what does he do? Does he succeed in doing that, or is he still basically trying to claim that he's functioning within the Code of Science criteria in Israeli politics?
I
mean,
he's
trying to
say he's
over the Code of Science. Right. That's my question is, right? My question is this working at all, or is this just a category error? That he is working on the Code of Chaim, and the Code of Chaim is not set up to address a society in which people don't share the same values and are not personally accountable to each other. Right? And if you try and take the Code of Chaim's criteria as is, right, as legal principles as opposed to a guide to virtue, and you try and translate that into an open, pluralist community which is too large, for personal communication. Like what you do is 1,000 people think it's just too big for personal communication. Right? And the president doesn't read an email. Right? There are 20 people delegated to read the president's email. Right? How do you implement this criteria? You have to tell somebody first. And is it really the obligation? A newspaper editor has 20 stories of corruption every day. Does he have to go and before he publishes and talk to each of those politicians? And say right before he publishes, or is the job of the newspaper to publish it when it's just full of an A? Okay, yes, Avi.
What's the problem with saying in principle that requirement that someone privately first, still stands with someone like Obama and his healthcare policy? But in practice, that you can't meet that. If I'm Rahm Emanuel, then I shouldn't speak to the foreign government if that's something, but what's at stake here? Why? Oftentimes, some of these conditions cannot be met.
And what do I do if I can't do that? What creates that there? Because if I can't meet the tie in order to do something, why does it make it looser as opposed to usher? I'm not forced to do it.
You're forced to...
I would make a broader point. There's a public interest in knowing the extent of public corruption. Right? That's right. I mean, that's the counter thesis, is that the public needs to be well informed. And hiding wrongdoing because the person said it was your tribute the first time. Right? First of all, most of the time you just get fooled. And they say that you should have to go away from you, and then they come back a year later, you discover you did it. And secondly, that right then, what happens is when somebody finally gets out, everyone says, why didn't you just sleep under the rug? I'm sure it's an exception. It's not a big deal. We don't have to make any systemic changes because that was the only one. Yes, no. I'm Jesse.
The system you just flip back and forth. Are we talking about ideological conflict or personal corruption? I think it's a big difference. This just needs to confront the person first. Like, when it comes to the ideological,
I think that perhaps you could say that the politicians are motivated, that they're public figures, they put themselves out there, and their ideas are subject to scrutiny. I don't know if that's necessarily true with their personal life. It might be with certain people, not with others. But in that sort of case, then I think there would be more of an obligation to confront the person's personal life.
Okay, so we're going to make the distinction between different kinds of listener.
Right. I think that requirement is entirely useful when it comes to accusation of crime.
Okay. I think that it is a useful move he makes to come up with the category of subjective criticism. I think that's a contribution that has value. Okay. Yes, Jonathan.
But they're not objectively positive or negative, and it's up to the public to figure out how they view it, right? Objective. You could have just said that at least that type of information, right, could be what they're just because, it's important that people know, and it's not bad. It's clear, it's not objectively bad information. It's information which everyone knows is, that it's however, I can say the exact same thing about, the facts about Obama's, plan for public health. And depending on how I feel about public health and the implications, take that as a reason to vote for him or against him.
So saying something like, where would there be a fire other than somebody else's house where they have lots of milk and meat, we said the whole thing that makes it worse is that you take objective facts and you spin them.
So not even spinning, I'm just saying, in order to fund public health care, taxes will have to be raised for the wealthy. You take that, and some people look at that exact information and say, fine, that should be the responsibility of the wealthy. And some people will say, no, I don't think it's the responsibility of the wealthy. The fact comes to anything. If you don't spend that, it doesn't mean anything. And if you're a social, the more socialist you are, the more likely you are to accept the better positive thing. The more you are, a lot of these are capitalists, the less likely you are. But there's nothing objective about those facts. And any type of information like that, which is a lot of information in politics, where it's simply what is your policy on this, what are the implications for society, but fundamentally I can't tell you whether they're positive or negative. I can't tell you what will happen or what is likely to happen. I know this is not where you stand on the issue. That suggestion is raised that I actually think could work, assuming you don't actually try to spin it, you just try to present it to sides and you leave it up to people to decide themselves, it might actually work, at least for some cases.
First of all, I want to respond to that. I think in some abstract world that may be true. You have to remember that when Obama presents and publishes his position, or when he calls it presents and publishes his position, they are going to spin that in such a way as to make them seem as positive as possible to as many people as possible. And to a certain extent, right, the press's job is not simply to, or let's forget the press, people's job, right? People who are involved in public debate, their job is not simply to repeat exactly what Obama said with his spin, or a politician with their spin, and leave it at that, right? But all of a sudden what you're saying is, right, what you're saying is what this politician said is misleading and wrong, and that's why you're wrong. That's straightforward, and you can do it according to him, because it's a total. But that doesn't matter. There are not too many situations in politics where positions are coming out presented in a calm, you know, objective way that you don't have to say this statement is misleading in some way. So almost all people, and that's, I think, the real issue there, right? But moving to what I think is a broader issue, which I think we're kind of ignoring the way he's distributing. On the one hand, he's way too open, I think, in terms of the way he discusses political campaigns. When it comes to a press, he sets up a situation where really, forget having to go to people every time you want to discuss an issue, right? The only newspaper stories that can exist in his world are advocacy stories, right? And maybe, you know, they're stories which, and maybe some general stories about information about policies, right? But, you know, general interest stories, a good chunk of criminal stories, which don't really serve much purpose beyond sensationalism. The bulk of what makes up your daily newspaper is out there, according to him. So I don't know, like, what kinds of institutions end up existing in the world that he creates, such that you can actually have a real open press following his guidelines, even assuming they followed his guidelines. If it was possible to follow his guidelines, you know, you'd have to have a group of people who make their living doing this. And it's not clear to me that there in a world where journalists follow these guidelines, the institutions could exist.
No, but they exist. And we can really take a look at it at some point and see how we think it is.
How do you exist? And it mostly exists because the people who read it and want to get real news get it somewhere else. And I think also Hovia exists and publishes lots of AP stories that would be other from the perspective of, like, they don't, Hovia has, I've tried to believe Hovia's city editor for a little while, alright? He published two stories in every issue, one under his name, one under a pseudonym, such that he was able to, so it looked like they had two reporters instead of one, and then tons of stuff off the wire. Like, Hamilton is not a real news-gathering organization, and in a world in which only newspapers like Hamilton existed, Hamilton wouldn't exist either.
Okay, I'm gonna do this. We're going to run out of time, and I'm going to have this get on into tomorrow. I'm going to present as best I can, as clearly funded as I can, what I his primary issues. I want to go through a few brief details in the article, which I think are important from the perspective of authority when we started, even though they're not necessarily getting into this issue. I don't think this works. That's the law. I think it's failed. But I think it's worth, but it's not an unmitigated failure, and it's worth deciding deciding on what grounds and whether you agree with it, because you have to figure out what your premises are. So the first question is, do you think democracy is good? Because that changes everything. Do you think it is a positive thing for people who have the public welfare to be accountable? Do you think it is a positive thing for the public to be informed? Do you think it is an obligation for citizens to be informed? That question drives everything else, I think. If you work on the premise that the ideal system is one of an elite, largely appointed, making decisions for which, and we'll see that we can read this topically, making decisions for which they are generally trusted by the population once appointed, right? And we'll see that that's very easy to argue that they, right? There are many occupations that argue that it's, that there is a chiyuv to trust the people you have elected, and that there is no chiyuv of public accountability, and then you have this intention of the Rashiva of Moshe giving public accounts. Right? But on the other hand, the statement when they did the Bedek bias, right, they didn't actually require accounting, given the Ayin Osim. I think the best in our Arkadian point that makes all the difference in the world. And a very much related question is whether you see halachic Jews as citizens or as an interest group. And therefore, whether what you're trying to do is set up the rules by which everyone has to play in the system, or you're saying is, given that everyone else plays this way, how do I think you can advance their interests? Right, so when you talk about what journalists do, so in one framework, the question is, granting that journalism is not a good thing, but granting also that we need to have some journalists to counter the non-Trump journalists, and from political hacks to counter the non-Trump political hacks, right, and from, you know, and from political attack dogs, you know, all those sorts of things. So is there a way in which we can tell these people that they still have souls? Which is a very different question than asking what should a political campaign be like, and do we have something to say to the society at large about what politics should be like? Do we have a question, right? Do we have something to say about what journalism should be, as opposed to answering the question of is it possible for us to have orthodox ethics in journalism? It wouldn't occur to him, I don't think, it was, maybe I'm being unfair, I don't know him, and I had that contact with his father, and I was very impressed. Suppose you had a story that worked against the interests of your party. Right? You believe in Shas, and you discover, much to your horror, that every member of Shas has its delegation is under indictment. And, if you publish that, of course not, right? There's no cause. It will cause people to lose their merit. Right? Everything has to be... Right. The notion that there is a value in informing the public so that they can make up their own minds in informed fashion. Right? So that you don't judge whether there's a duality. The duality is that people should be informed so that they can judge what the duality is. Right? That doesn't exist. That was the tension that we saw between Mark Kirkwood on the one hand, and Gary Rosenblatt, and Shira on the other hand, right, as to whether, right, to some degree, right, to some degree as to whether you see yourself as directly involved in consequences, or whether your job is simply to provide information on the, right, either on the presumption that better information leads to better consequences, or on the systemic claim that the people who will suffer the consequences are the ones who get determined. They have a right to be informed well enough to make that decision. And that's a fundamentally democratic supposition. In a framework in which you say that, let's take Shira's formulation, that you have an obligation to provide the public with an accurate portrait. Not just of individual people, but of the government as a whole, of the framework as a whole. So then, the kind of case-by-case phenomena that the Tommy Klein talks about don't really come into play. So the question is not whether it's a toilet for me to know that this mayor is corrupt, and really I should go to him and get a new tshuva. And the toilet is for the public to know whether mayors are corrupt. And they have a right to make their own decisions, so I can't just publish a digest saying, well, this year, 10 mayors stole $20 million, and here are the names of two of the other 18 in Trudeau. Right? Good play. Right? You can't do that. Right? That's not a... That to me is the fundamental issue at stake. The two axes I set out at the very beginning, to me, are what... one is public-private, right? Whether the definition of the public good in knowledge is primary and then ends up, Lamont says, in the practice of journalism, making many of the criteria that we use in individual, to govern individual interpersonal relationships relevant. And then we can figure out what the boundary is between professional journalists and individuals, because everybody has situations in which they are in quasi-journalistic capacities. If you're in different positions in different societies, it may be that you are in something like a journalistic capacity, or that in some way you contribute to the, an interesting test case is an interview subject. Right? If you say a journalist has an obligation to provide an accurate portrait, and now do I have a fius to give the journalist an accurate portrait so that the journalist can report an accurate portrait, or is it my job to try and keep all the information that let the journalist have a balanced portrait from them, although I hope that they will overcome my deception or my stonewalling? Yes,
right.
Can
you formulate that in terms of
the favor, or is it separate? No, I don't know that it's an author for a journalist either, right? To get an unbalanced portrait. It'd be interesting to argue that a journalist who gives an unbalanced portrait is, right? So I'm not talking about whether in reverse. Maybe something which would be Lashon Hara to say to my friend is not Lashon Hara if I say it to a journalist. Let's take the case that I gave you. You're writing a story celebrating somebody's award. And now I would add to your thesis, right? This is a case that we talked about agarism, but I remember it made a deep impression on me. At the end of the first ADA conference, Rav Riskin, as the closing peroration, got up and said, and we all have to remember a man that we owe a great debt to, the man who brought, genuine spiritual fervor to non-Orthodoxy, or Shlomo Kalba. And Leah Shaktiel, some of you may know, the first woman in a religious council in Israel, Leah Shaktiel grabs the mic and says, but we also need to mention that he took sexual advantage of underage women. Now, when I asked her later why she said it, it happens that she had a daughter, Trisha, I think. I mean, that's been at Harvard for a while, so we had over for Shabbat lunch. It made a deep impression on me, that moment. It's why I still have deep ambivalence, but it's all that I know something from her. I have this constant ambivalence. Because she said was, there were women in that room who felt silent, and that their experience was disregarded because you were getting up there praising somebody who had victimized them. And that way, you can't, right, every time you praise somebody who was cruel to others, right, you're denying the experience of the people they were cruel to. And in a public setting, you have an obligation. It's not just a question of credibility. It's a question of purpose. I have an obligation not to disenfranchise minorities, not to disenfranchise victims.
So she had asking had a conversation with Mark Riskin, and he was like, you owe a lot of gratitude to the Shlomo Kalba religious brother that he bought.
She has to retort right back and say, she also... In a private conversation? I don't think she feels like a bonus. She tries to also say it to her risk, so she didn't go around doing the same kind of thing again. He responded interestingly. Yes, you're right, we have to acknowledge that, but nevertheless. I think that was in response. I would say both the people who dispute the allegations, I don't. And it's why I have really deep concern. I'm always worried that if I get up acting a Karl Bach in shul, that somebody's listening to it is not experiencing a beautiful spiritual moment, but is experiencing it as an attack. So I have really deep hesitation about using Karl Bach in shul. I said that at all, and you're really uncomfortable with the universe that you have today. Okay. But, that's how I feel like, you know, it's a deep impact on me. She's a baby woman. This was a tremendous experience having her. But I think that you could argue that there's a journalistic obligation to present the full portrait, and that if we frame that the community's soellus is for there to be honest portraits, then the question is, well, I am not a journalist, but if I don't tell the journalist who's interviewing me, if we claim that there's an insert on the women to talk about Karlbach, then the journalist will fulfill their obligation. And whatever the soil is, right, the community vanishes. Yes, Justin.
To a large extent, what you're doing is providing a rationale for the simple reading of Sophie Moore Bach.
Sure.
Right. I just want to say that. Like, it's really, really easy to say, and look, you know, when you say something to a journalist and the journalist publishes it, that's very clearly public. You're not concerned about what anyone else is going to say. It's like Bobby's Bossa. And it's Twitter.
As long as you don't do it anonymously.
Yeah, as long as you don't do it honestly, exactly. And I think there's the problem is that, I'm not saying there isn't a problem, but I think like you're throwing in a flawless argument which doesn't necessarily play in there, but really all that's doing is providing a rationale.
Could be. I don't know.
I think that could be a way to go, if that's what you
want
to say.
I think you're running one possibility of putting halachic language that way, right? So the other possibility I'm offering is that you talk about soil on the super level as opposed to on the upper level. And then you have to deal with the interplay or possible clash between individual obligations, which I classify as virtual obligations, and communal obligations, which I'm classifying as policy obligations. But I want to add that I don't want to discount the issue of what constitutes a virtuous community. If you're thinking about the story about lunch yesterday, right, so one is the story about the importance of journalism, the other hand is the story about the utterly destructive phenomenon of Lashon Hara community. Right, you know, so journalism managed to end the campaign of Lashon Hara, much of which was true, except they're literally designing it. Right, so it's nothing, what's our, you know, writing an article with, you know, about Ducky Mamre. I'm not comfortable just creating a disjunction, individual versus community policy. I think, and this relates to my critique of every old article, I think that a responsible halakhic public policy is concerned about the virtue of the community, such that I'm not comfortable saying that it's okay for the Orthodox community to engage in political sign throwing just like the non-Orthodox, just because that, guess what, that's how the system runs. On the other hand, I am perhaps willing to acknowledge that, let's say, somebody is hearing on Meet the Press, does not have 20 minutes to think about everything they say, and yet you can't refuse to put people on Meet the Press and the other side has something they have to figure out. And that's why you have to think, you know, you have to create space where you have to create a framework where people can react to situations in some way other than sitting down and going through a series of texts in their head. You have to create guidelines that people can internalize and then utilize in spontaneous action. Right? That's why it's interesting to me to think about what do we, you know, do we think that the best possible way to prepare from Jews to journalists is really intensive study of the Lashon Hara? Maybe not. Maybe the best way, maybe if we train enough Lashon Hara, then they just read them, they react that what they learn to do is the biggest technical evasions in particular situations. What we need to do is to train them to have certain really deep ethical convictions and reject everything like that. And I'm open to that. I want to address, you know, flat out the question of whether what journalism looks like in a virtuous society. right? A society where most people are basically from, and most people are basically good, but some people are not, and you don't know which ones are which, right? And there are people in power, and the people in power are susceptible to the particular constraint around power. Right, what does journalism look like in that society? Okay, a healthy issue. Right, what does journalism look like in a healthy issue? In other contexts, they address what governance looks like in a healthy issue. Right, to what degree do we see, right, do we see democracy as a value and yet frame it that there's an age and knowledge issue and you can't, right, and not every, and democracy is not best for every, all of our positions. Right now I just want to know, right, what I want to do is, I want to figure out a way to balance. So I start from a presumption that democracy of some form is better than authoritarianism. Not that it's good, it's just better than all the others. And that public accountability is a necessity in every system. And that saying bad things about people, it's always bad if you're in a shaman. And that there is great beauty in a community in which people are always down the cut, in which, right, they will never, in which they always try to fulfill the chayach sofia rather than keep it not safi chadulodata. I think there's beauty in that and moral power, and it's where I want to live. But there, I think Gabriel has a good point. I want to live that way. That will end up with my simply not responding to vicious attacks people will make on me. But I don't like Gabriel's framework. And on that level, I don't like the Holy Client framework.
So I'm the Holy Client addresses that question. The straightforward thing is, in the public plan, in the Yona, and this is not necessarily a critique, it's just a reality description, and they can't really conceive of a community in which some people and Kofim Mechal Shop for Hesia recognize each other as citizens. So that the goal is that you have to create a level playing field. Right, not because you can't let them win, but because you have a joint responsibility, right, in which you can see each other as partners, because there is not necessarily an irreconcilable divide on this issue. Okay, and that to me is interesting when you talk about what is journalistic ethics and how modern reflection is ethics of both professions. And it seems to me that that in general, unorthodox Jews consciously, and Haredi Jews often either less consciously or much more defensively, end up functioning simply within the norms of their professions, and halacha is simply a phenomenon to be evaded. The metaphor for this is bankers. So the difference between halachic bankers and non-halachic bankers is whether you find a heteriska. That's the only difference. And as a halachic banker, the shaylos you will ask or not, should I be charging this person, right, for lending them money? The question you have to ask is, which heter is best in order to allow this? Right? Those are the shaylos you're asking mortgage law. Right? No level has ever gotten a shaylos. Well, you know what? This person's really poor. Maybe my team has to give me an interest free loan as opposed to an interest based loan. Right? The child will be more like, this person's really poor. It's utterly unlikely that if I give them this money that they would use it for investment. Does that invalidate their risk of? If they're, right, because they're not going to have any ready cash at all, and so there's no possibility they're investing it. Right? So there's no difference. My wealth has no impact on the banking industry. Around the virtue of the people engaged in the banking industry, none whatsoever. This, I think, is what has been really well formulated, the issue about the Hetzer Mechira. The issue is not whether the Hetzer Mechira works or not,
The issue is, what kind of wild, sad, terrifyingly sad thing is it when the dispute is about whether we can keep halakha by halakha al-shmita, which is supposed to be about, which is supposed to be about, you know, let's say, values of social egalitarianism and attachment or control. Right, what do we do? We have to figure out whether it works to tell Eretz Yisrael, and force all Israeli farmers into poverty because we ban all Jews worldwide from buying their fruit. Whether you think that that's all halakha can do or not is one question, but it's not like we should celebrate that we can keep shmita by telling Eretz Yisrael. Or that we can keep shmita by driving all Israeli farmers into poverty, which are basically the options we have right now. But it's a crazy thing, right, that last year in America, right, one of the major kashrut framings, right, was all kashrut agency banned all Israeli produce. Right, you have to ask, your non-Jewish store owner is coming to say, well, you know, right, they say, well, are all fruits kosher? Sure, all fruits are kosher. Except Israeli fruit. Can't use Israeli fruit. Especially not if it's grown by Jews. Right? It's ridiculous. As is the notion that the only way you can live in Eretz Yisrael is by dwelling as a non-Jew. Otherwise, economically, living in Eretz Yisrael is impossible. Both of those are absurd. Maybe it's all we have, you know, because that's one of the fun. Maybe that's one of those are the only solutions we have. So that's not right. So I don't want to create a framework in which the only difference between a firm journalist and not a firm journalist is that it takes the firm journalist 10 seconds longer to justify writing the story. That doesn't work for me. So that's the mandate I would put out. Right? What I would like to come out with is an understanding of halakha that sees journalism as an integral part of any society, and which I think, although again none of this is binding, will mean that it has to recognize the value of an informed citizenry as central to the rest, to any notion of what a community should be. But that sharply distinguishes between the need for the public to be informed as such and the need for individuals to be informed, and recognizes the ambiguous lines when we talk about the public, because what constitutes the community? Sometimes the family is the community, sometimes the school is the community, sometimes the shul is the community, right? Whatever corporate body you think people have obligations of citizenship towards will generate the good of the threat of an informed citizenry. And you can decide it, right? You know, for example, one major area of conflict, right, which certainly is central to things that happen in my life, is whether you consider the students to be the citizens of the yeshiva or a college or a university, or not. You can consider them the consumers and not the citizens. And that was a fundamental issue, right, where we tended to see ourselves as the collective monarchist community of the future. Right, dealing with the institution that was required, that was the guardian of that future, and so we were citizens. It was entirely reasonable to say that, you know, right, we were consumers, and we had no right, and so what right do we have, right? We could buy or not buy, right? But I walk into a store, I don't necessarily have a new phenomenon. I don't necessarily have a right to know what goes on in the labor practices. Or you might argue that consumers are citizens, right? But, you know, right? Because you're supporting them, so that creates obligations, right? This is a really interesting and sophisticated political science question, which I want to suggest is critical to framing halakha about these issues. But I want to say, you know, set up, if you're saying the hakira is, are we dealing with people or citizens? Citizens need to be informed, people don't always. There's a difference between, right, this is a very classical distinction between private virtue and public virtue.
But there is such a thing as public friction. Right, so I don't want to say that it's for the public good. The public needs to be informed about everything, so it makes no difference. Okay, that's what, right, that's, yes, sir.
Can you give me an idea case where you think criticism consumers?
Yes. I had a conversation, right, I know that this teacher, that this teacher is being honored, and I'm having a conversation with you, and you say, oh, I hear that Mr. Johnson's being honored, isn't it really sweet, 25 years of great teaching? Now, I know that Mr. Johnson, right, I know that Mr. Johnson, right, wasn't the great teacher the first 6 years of his career. And his first 6 years of his career is a very mediocre career, was a very mediocre teacher, and then at some point he had, right, he had this amazing experience. He met some classy teacher trainer and he became a great teacher. So I need to say, yeah, he was a great teacher for the last 19 years. No. But if a reporter comes to me, perhaps, and says, so can you reflect on Mr. Johnson's career? Well, if I'm a reporter, I might have to write, you know, if Mr. Johnson writes for you, right, after 6 years of mediocrity, right, he met so-and-so on the camera, but right, because it might be that that's a public training. Right, but there's no reason whatsoever I should have to tell you about that.
In the first case, I'm assuming it was consumer case, and the second case is clue citizen case. But, I mean, there's no one consumer. Consumers are a group of people. I mean,
that's right.
There are other consumers, and we let the other.
Well, not even a consumer in the second case, right? Somebody that's talking about a story in the town. Right, as an individual, right, which is not a big enough story to be a big town, to be a town story, not in a newspaper. So if you ask me privately, I don't need to give you a balanced portrait of everyone in your life. That's my claim. If I know, right, if I remember that obviously that in college, right, every once in a while, I like to see if you could get ahead in college. I remember that. Okay, right, right here, you're reminiscing about your dad. And I feel right. And you ask the question, you talk about something. I say, oh, I remember the time. He came carousing home dead drunk at midnight after a bad exam. Right, I really had no idea. Right, really had no idea at all. I'm just still getting over having a student whose father was in college at the same time. There's no reason whatsoever I should say that. But on the other hand, it might be that if somebody's writing a public profile, that I at least need to tell the reporter so the reporter can decide, right, because the reporter will know what other people told similar stories, and can then decide whether that is necessary for a balanced portrait or not, if you see having a balanced portrait of public officials. Right, so when Jeffrey Rosen, right, we didn't talk about his most recent book, which is a collection of portraits of Supreme Court justices, right, he didn't really didn't ask people afterwards whether there's a profile of Anthony Kennedy. Whether he had changed the profile earlier or not in that. If I believe that part of having informed citizenry is that we have a balanced portrait of our leaders, so then stories that we never tell their kids, I might tell a reporter. Especially if I trusted that reporter to put it in only if, in fact, again, because, as I said last night, when you give a portrait, you always have to, you're putting in an infinite amount of information into a limited number of pixels. Right? So I shouldn't say that. So a responsible reporter, if they hear one person telling a story like that, a good reporter might say, well, the story is much more interesting that way, where an ethical reporter might say, it's not necessary to round out the portrait and its being. And that's right, and that would be a credit, right, you know, that would be a, that might be one of the places where, right, where the kind of client makes a real difference.
I understand you feel like a different paradigm. I think the reason I feel like it's for me, it's either way, it's consumer and I don't understand the distinction really, because I think either way they are owed the right to know what's going on.
See that? Okay, well, that's the thing that I'm following. So, let's say, that's actually a valuable question that I need to figure out how to. I'm talking very personally. Okay? So contract. So a lot of this is in halacha. It's just trying to explain where one of my problems is that I tend to feel responsible for organizations I join, and that's why I always resisted joining organizations. Like I sort of came into the line back sideways, not really wanting to do it. Because I know that when I join an organization, I start feeling responsible for it. But I don't feel responsible for the workings of the Boston Globe, even though I buy it. If the Boston Globe internally has a really mediocre management culture. And there's sometimes lost in their means of people. If it's really, rises to the level of desperately immoral, I might have a hallucinatory problem. But suppose the Globe is just adequate. Right? Do I feel an obligation to change the Globe so it's more than adequate, so it's a stellar place to work? No. I just buy the Globe. Right? It's not my responsibility. And therefore, if somebody comes to me on the Globe and says, "Look, you buy the Globe. You need to know that my boss was mean to me last week." No, he doesn't. Who cares? I'm not going to change, right? So one boss of the Globe was mean to somebody last week. It's very nice to know, but that's fine. But I'm not right. Go talk to your union. I have no need to know that. But if you tell me the same thing about the boss, yeah, I need to know. Yes, right. I didn't know if the supervisor of the VOD was mean to an employee. Right now, interesting questions are, what do I feel about my kid's school? Right? Do I feel that I'm honoring school, right? An honoring school is a community of parents and kids, and we all, right, together create this institution that the community is invested in. We take our sums of money to it, we send our kids to it, and therefore, maybe if somebody told me that there was an administrator of Maimonides who was mean to faculty, even if it didn't affect my kids' education, I might go into school and say, you know what? I send my kids here. And it might be, I want to know that as a parent because I feel sufficiently invested. Or it might not be. It might be I say, no, I go to Maimonides, all I care about is what my kids get. Right? Even though I pay large sums of money to support the school, and even though if a school thinks of us as a community, and in many ways, it functions as a communal institution. And this, by the way, is a really interesting legal case because the court's rules that Maimonides was exempt from unemployment tax because even though the standard was it has to be an organization largely controlled by a church or religious community. Right, so the question came out whether Maimonides set the criteria because the rest of the community doesn't have any kind of control. And it's really interesting. We look at the court ruled that Maimonides was substantially supported by the Jewish community and by the synagogue there. And therefore could be quite qualified under the statute as a religious organization. I think that's just because I have perhaps an overdeveloped sense of responsibility and citizenship, so it's a really critical thing in my life to try and decide which organizations I feel compelled to change and improve, and which organizations, unless they meet a critical threshold, I can largely ignore.
And I think that really what you're saying is that you value different things differently. You value the bottom one, you value the globe.
No.
I think if he can corral enough people to change what's going on, then I think he has that right. And I think you also have the choice or obligation, whichever you want to see, to stop purchasing the Boston Globe. The same way if you go to a restaurant. I know, personally speaking, like, there's a restaurant where someone I know is, like, verbally harassed with an employee, And, like, if they spread their word, they're not, and I spread their word, they're not, then, you know, that option is there. I don't really do this thing.
Okay, let me try again. I should say, it's a great critique, and I'm not getting it across my point that maybe it was wrong. I want to try again. There are organizations I feel responsible to that I value less than organizations I don't feel responsible for. Right, that's why I would start by saying that. Right. There are really important things, let's say, like the American Red Cross is a really important thing. I don't feel any need to improve the American Red Cross. If something is going wrong in the Red Cross that isn't an immediate threat to people, the American Red Cross is doing a mediocre job, right, and somebody specifically there is doing a bad job, I don't need to know that. I'm not going to do anything about it. I don't feel obligated to do anything about it. It's a really, really important organization that I am not a citizen of. Right? There are many, many charitable, right? There are many yeshivot in the world that are mediocre. I don't feel obligated to fix everyone, and I don't want every Rebbe and every yeshiva in the country coming and telling me what the principles mean to them.
So they have to find out which yeshiva you care about, and then they can only talk about that.
To me, I think that it's important for somebody to feel responsible for this issue. It might be that at some point I would say I take responsibility for an issue, right? But I don't have an inherent responsibility to improve the working. The workings of every mediocre yeshiva with mediocre managers in the country. I'm not a citizen of that yeshiva. I might have obligations as a citizen of the Jewish community to contribute to organizations that improve governance in yeshivas. But I have no interest in knowing the information directly. And if somebody came to me, if I talk to somebody who's working one of those yeshivas, and they say, you know, Rabbi Klapper, you really got to know that the vice principal here is a mediocre administrator and sometimes loses her temper? No, I don't. Why do I need to know that? Unless there is some kind of global responsibility to be informed about yeshiva in general so I can make good decisions about my local one. But if that happens to the nowadays, I think I have much more of a responsibility. I think in the nowadays I'm much more of a citizen. If I joined the RCA, and this is why I have resisted all these years, and I think I would feel responsible for all the things the RCA didn't do. Let's say, for example, if the RCA declared it was going to start a commission that would establish even voluntary guidelines for employment treatment, and thereby created the impression that it took the Rebashkins net seriously. And it turned out that commission had never been created, and this is just a sham for public relations. And I remember the RCA saying, gosh darn it, I would have to fight that through leaving everyone mad at me. I was responsible not being member of the RCA. It remains, right, you know, the question I have to consider is whether failure to join the RCA is an abdication of responsibility for the Orthodox Rabbinic community, or whether I say, guess what, I'm not a member of the RCA, you know, and I'm glad, because I'm not responsible for this.
But does that mean that any of the doing of the RCA is your responsibility by virtue of the fact that you're a member? But that specific issue is important to you, and since you're a member, you need to respond.
I think that one of the...
So that's a
different thing. No, I think one of the issues, the other question, is there someone that's a listener? That's what you told them, that we'll do that in 5 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
We'll hold off while you go. And we'll take 5 minutes a little bit. I have an aesthetic sense of responsibility on some issues, and that's one of the things I'm trying to control, that when I join organizations, you know, that's what happened at YU, and I felt like a citizen, and so whenever things were wrong, I felt the need to write to the rescue, because all my friends don't have to save the world against it, and wait that they've not come to save it. I don't necessarily encourage everyone else to have that. You might define citizenship much more tightly than I do. You might define it much more broadly. Right? You might extend it. You might take the vision that every time you buy something, that makes you a stakeholder, right? Which creates a sense of responsibility. I don't tend to have that sense of responsibility in terms of an individual economic purchaser. Right? That's not my issue. But I think that So, again, it doesn't mean that I think that the Azad is more important than the Boston Globe. I think it's an interesting question. But I, you know, for the Globe, I'm just a guy who pays money to get the paper delivered. I don't see myself as, you know, that's the only decision I make. Is it bad enough? Is something going on that's so bad that I can't justify paying for it? I don't feel any obligation to make it better while I'm paying for it. That's the only, I just have a threshold decision. Bad enough to make me boycott, not bad enough to make me boycott. Whereas with Avad, I feel a constant obligation to see if I can make it better. Not an obligation that regrettably I have tremendous success fulfilling, but the Orthodox community generally, I feel that way. Right, that's sort of why I'm here. I don't feel that way, for better or for worse, I don't really feel that way so much about the city of Somerville. That's probably an abdication of responsibility. Even though I live there, you know, it's not, I probably shouldn't. I feel it's a lack. I choose the organizations that become involved in not because they are important, because I think I can do the most good. And sometimes because I have no choice. Right, I'm already involved, you know, I don't think I can do so much, but I have no choice, I'm a citizen. I think that's, is that better? Not necessarily? Okay, I have 2 minutes anyway. Let's break this formally and we can all think about it in the next 2 days. And we'll see where we are.